Collective wow. So is it ever possible to stay on the continent?
Some trips offer camping on the seventh continent.
Oh, that sounds like our cup of tea, Barbara.
I hope it's at a reduced rate.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
We're so glad you tuned in.
First, the husband and wife award-winning documentary duo opens up about their remarkable careers.
Then, what's it really like to protect a president and his family? An investigative journalist shares his insights.
Next, why a trip to Antarctica should be on your bucket list.
Plus, a story of how life can turn on a dime after a traumatic brain injury.
And the best small town in America. Could yours take the crown? Paul and Holly Fine are legendary in the television news business. They are rare, a husband and wife documentary team with a career spanning 4 decades. They have produced news reports and documentaries for 60 Minutes, Nightline, Primetime, and 2020, just to name a few.
The award-winning Fines have earned more than 80 Emmys, a Peabody Lifetime Achievement Award, and the New York Film Festival Grand Prize. Paul and Holly Fine join us by phone to share highlights from their remarkable career. Welcome, Fines.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How did you become involved in the documentary film business? I mean, was that always on your radar screen?
Not really, no. My father was a photographer. He was the Redskins photographer, and he asked me one day if I was helping him carry equipment up. He was up in the press box, and he said, "Do you want to go on the field and make pictures?" And I said, "Sure," not because to make pictures, but I could be on the bench with the Redskins. And then made pictures that game, didn't know if they came out. They did come out, and he wanted to know if I wanted to make pictures for the program, book every game. So that lasted, besides a regular job, for 15 years working for the Redskins doing their game day photos. And then got a break at Channel 7, WJLA, now in Washington. Snuck in the door, sort of, when the beginning of television news, and that's how I got in television.
Wow. So, Holly, how about you? How did you get into the business?
I graduated with a degree in psych and math and drama and thought, gee, I'm going to go do something before I get my master's degree. And I wanted to go into drama, but I figured television drama, they're both the same. Not quite. Anyway. And they had a management trainee program at Channel 7, and I applied and was accepted and started there and then did all the different jobs they gave me to do. And then when I got into editing, it was a good fit, and they hired me as a full-time editor in their documentary unit. And Paul, at that point, he was doing news, and we had started going out, and I said, come in the documentary unit, we can make a difference. And he goes, I don't want to do that because documentaries are boring talking heads. And I said, no, no, we can change all that. So he fought me a bit, but then he said, okay. And they brought him in, and then that was it.
Well, how cool. So you two had this great love affair or whatever, you know, falling
Kathy.
In love on the job, I suppose.
Right. That was a no-no back then.
Yeah. Ooh, so yeah. How was it addressed or what went on with the station?
We got called up into the president's office and he brought us up there and he asked me questions. How would you like it if your wife was bending over getting coffee and another person looked up her skirt? Would that bother you? He was trying to keep us from getting married is what he was doing, because it didn't happen then. It was against the rules.
And all of this was always addressed to Paul, nothing to me. When you come home from work at night, my wife is home. She hands me a drink. She listens to everything that went on at work all day. And if I'm wrong about something, she supports me. When you come home, your wife will know if you were wrong. You won't have that support. Do you want to live with that? Mm-hmm. But there was nothing addressed to me. It was only to him. How would he feel with these circumstances? So anyway, we convinced him, and they put us on probation. And then that June, we won the first 4 Emmys, and they said, oh, you know, you can be off of probation now.
You so. Showed them.
Yeah.
So. And there was the majority of Emmys for the station that season, wasn't it, or that year?
Oh, yeah, there were only 5, and we won 4.
Wow.
Right, so they were always lagging behind in that category, in all of those categories, so we helped them there, yeah.
Success is a best revenge, right?
It sure is. It sure is.
I think what we did was different than anybody and still a lot different than what local news does. We had a boss that really believed in us. His name was Len Dybert. And we tried to convince them, instead of doing news conferences and talking heads, to do a story about what the people are talking about. And so we wound up doing many profiles of stories and started to do stories where you actually get into people's heads and start telling personal stories. And they liked it, and they ran a lot of stuff that we did on the news. We also started the first music video ever done.
Wow.
We went to the circus, and we filmed all the clowns in slow motion, and Holly cut it to send in the clowns. And they ran it on the news. They got a great response, and probably the best response we ever got was the clowns watched the show together, and they all cried and hugged.
That is so
great. Well, Paul, let me ask you, after 12 years at the D.C. affiliate, your careers, both of yours, really took off after a documentary you made about the attempt on President Reagan's life. Can you tell us about that and why it was such a game changer for you guys?
We got approached by George Washington University, and Channel 7 said go talk to them, and they wanted to do what happened to the president when he got to the hospital, but they wanted to do it with interviews with doctors and nurses.
A roundtable discussion.
And complete access to all that. But we had an idea to maybe do some recreation with the real doctors and nurses that did it, but they didn't want to do that, and they made me sit in an emergency room to wait, which I thought was ridiculous for a gunshot wound like the president's, that they thought they would look the same and everything. Well, I sat for a week and nothing happened, so finally, all the doctors decided they would do this, and we just recreated the whole day. We did interviews with everyone, audio interviews, and that became the script for the show. And Holly did this mostly, put it together like a movie, but with real people. And we only did what they said, and they started acting it out. And some doctors didn't want to do it, but when they saw other doctors do it, they joined in. And we wound up recreating that day and the operation that Reagan had, and the only actor was the couple Secret Service guys, and the president was an actor, but you never saw his face.
We read that one critic wrote about your work, saying you both were recognized for, and I quote, using a distinctive style to put a human face to complex issues. What did he mean by that?
Listening to people, talking to them without a camera, trying to be involved in their life and getting them to trust you. Our big thing was getting people to trust us, and we would work on that very hard, promise never to hurt a person. And we just had lots of conversations without cameras before we started working to try and gain the trust of them and them to trust us. And that style pretty much worked for us. It takes a little time, and it takes a lot of patience. Sometimes you're not that happy to be sitting with the person, but you do it and you listen to them. And that worked for us practically all the way through our career.
We did the first AIDS ward in the United States in San Francisco General. And at that time, there were news stories about doctors wearing hazmat suits in operations and things on their face in case blood got splattered on them. And the fear, just like it's going on now, the fear was even worse. And we decided to go live in this ward with these people dying of AIDS. With the nurses, there were no doctors in that ward because the doctors had given up on these patients. And we went there and we showed you what it's like for these nurses day in and day out. We showed you that the fear was unfounded, and you learned what was happening, and you learned that this was a crisis that had to be addressed. I think that's putting a human face on the AIDS crisis.
And wasn't that also Meredith Vieira's first 60 Minutes story?
It was one of her first. She was just amazing. She came in, sat on those beds with those men, and held their hands and talked to them so that she would know what the story was all about. She's just a terrific reporter.
As a producer, I was there probably for close to 2 weeks before she showed up. So I had gained the trust of all these people, and you worry that when the correspondent walks in, will they be at ease? Will they be as open? Well, she just walked in and put every one of them at ease, sat on the bed for hours talking to them without a camera and everything. So we were really impressed with her the first time we worked with her.
We're talking with Paul and Holly Fine, an award-winning husband-wife documentary team. They've been in the business for 4 decades, working for 60 Minutes, Nightline, Primetime, 2020, and more. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can hear our program anytime on iHeartRadio or at twoboomerbabes.com. Now back to our conversation with Paul and Holly Fine. So, Holly, I want to ask you about your stint with 60 Minutes team with Mike Wallace, who is not known for being a wilting violet. What was that like?
Well, he was the one correspondent we were really avoiding because we don't do investigative pieces, and that isn't our thing, and we really didn't want to get thrown into that box with him. And he had quite a reputation, so we avoided and avoided. And I think Paul ran into him in the men's room at one of the Christmas parties, and he said something like, "When are you ever going to work with me?" And he said, "Well, never, if I can help it." we don't do what you do. And he said, "Yes, you do. I like human stories. Bring me something." So we took him the story of Mitch Snyder. He was the homeless advocate in Washington during the Reagan era and was trying to open a shelter here. And at the tail end of the story, he went on a hunger strike, and he knew the peace was going to be on the air. And how would Reagan look if he was dying and Reagan hadn't opened the shelter and he caved in the night before the peace went on the air? That was our first story with Mike, and boy, he was terrific, really. And we found out later that he was suffering from depression during that time, and we didn't know it. You could not know it. You couldn't tell at all. We saw he had a heart, and we saw that he could do human stories really well, and we wanted to work with him all the time if we could. But we worked with many of the correspondents, not just one, and that's because we did documentaries too. Each correspondent has their stable of producers, and we couldn't take one of those slots, so we were floaters.
We kind of were in a good spot because we could pick the correspondent we thought fit the story and which one would do the best job and fit the person we were doing, so we were kind of at an advantage there.
Yeah, we had got to do Grand Central with Morley Safer with his writing and his art background and what was going on when they were renovating there and the historical aspects. That was all wonderful with him. You know, Mike, we did a couple who were mentally challenged who got married and then had a child, and we did two stories on them, and that was absolutely fantastic stories. And they were, again, the human aspect of being mentally challenged. Mike Wallace is interviewing mentally challenged people. That isn't usually seen on network television.
And there was also an interview which was also from a very different perspective, and that was one with Mike Wallace and Barbara Streisand. And I recently watched it again, and it just made me have a sweat because it was so nerve-wracking, really, even almost uncomfortable. Why on earth would Barbara Streisand do this interview?
Marty Ehrlichman, her manager, and Mike and Barbara go back a long way, and Marty called Mike and said, "Prince of Tides is coming out. Would you like to interview her for 60 Minutes? And Mike said, "Well, maybe. I don't know." He said, "You know, she can't see it before it goes on the air because she usually sees everything before it goes on the air and gives her okay." "Yes, we know that. Well, we trust you." And so he called Paul and I and said, "Do you want to do this story?" And I said yes. Paul said no. And we were on a plane in 3 hours because Mike said, "Well, you're doing it. So get your tickets and get to California. She wants to meet you tonight,
he said.
We were on a plane. Off we went. Sat with her, had dinner, talked to her for, got to be 8 or 9 hours. I don't know. I was falling asleep. I have to have 6 hours of sleep a night, and it was just way past my bedtime. Anyway, we talked for a long time, and she liked us. We liked her. We thought it was interesting. But we didn't want to do your normal, regular, what's your next movie, what's your next song. We wanted to delve more into her personality. And then Mike figured out how he wanted to do that, unbeknownst to Paul and I. And then... And he did it. And it was excruciating during the interview because he really, he just went after her in every way, shape, and form. Although Prince of Tides was about going to a counselor and finding out about yourself and psychotherapy and all this. And she'd been in psychotherapy for 25 years. So he asked her, "What could you possibly need to know more about yourself?" Things like that. And we were like, "Oh, my God." Anyway, we're sitting there. But we thought she held her own coming back at him with her answers. And he did. I think we all felt good about how she responded to his questions. And then went and cut the piece, took the piece to New York, and Mike hated it because he thought he looked too mean. And then Don Hewitt saw it and said, don't change a frame. I love
wow.
the story. I love it. I love it. It's so different. It gets inside her more than anything I've ever seen.
Well, finally, you guys have been working together for decades, and you're still married, which is fabulous. Paul, let me ask you, what's it like working with your spouse for so many years?
Totally honest and brutal sometimes. When we work in the editing room, and I'll give an example, and Holly would take one of my sequences out or shots that I liked, we'd get in an argument all the time. And when we had associate producers around us or people in the editing room, when we started arguing, they would back off and leave the room and go somewhere else.
That was very smart.
But the good thing was that we were totally honest with each other, and it made the product better. And a lot of times people can't be totally honest with each other, and we were. And we made sure that when we left work, we left all that at the door and went home and played family and left the producing part of it there. But, I mean, there was great times editing together. I miss it.
Yeah, I think we both do. But, you know, we did try to leave it at work, but I'm not sure we were always so successful in that.
Well, award-winning husband-wife documentary team Paul and Holly Fine, thanks so much for sharing your remarkable career and your journey with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Secret Service agents have unprecedented access to the first families of the United States. What are they really like? And what does it take to get this detail?
Joining us by phone from Maryland is Ron Kessler, a former Wall Street Journal and Washington Post investigative reporter and best-selling author. Ron's latest book is The First Family Detail, Secret Service Agents Reveal the Hidden Lives of the Presidents. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Hey, great to be with you.
Well, you have lots and lots of pretty juicy stories in your book about presidents and the agents sworn to protect them. But first of all, how did you get access to all these stories?
Usually I would waterboard them. That worked pretty well. you know, it's a combination of things. On the one hand, I think they feel that I tell an honest story. When an agency does well, as the FBI has since 9/11, that's why we have not had a successful foreign terrorist attack. I say that. And that's a little unusual with journalists these days. On the other hand, when they screw up, and one of my FBI books led to this dismissal of William Sessions as FBI director over his abuses, then, of course, I expose that. In addition, I think they feel I already have a lot of sources. I already know a lot. And then I listen. You know, I did a book on Palm Beach, of all things, which is another secret society. And one of the people there said, you know, nobody here listens to anybody. You listen. It doesn't sound like much of a skill, but I think all these things help.
But, Ron, don't agents have to sign a don't-tell oath if they join the Secret Service?
They do, ever since I revealed the fact that agents hired prostitutes in Colombia. But before that, there was no written agreement. On the other hand, it was certainly understood that you never reveal anything, regardless of whether you're a current agent or a former agent. So it really was a breakthrough to actually get them to talk.
Because it seems like lately in the news, of course, you know, with the Navy SEALs revealing all about this bin Laden, you know, mission, and then the Secret Service agents talking about the lax security, it just seems like, you know, whatever happened to agents keeping their secrets to the grave? And, you know, well, there's also a concern about national security.
I think, you know, the fact that there has been so much laxness and really negligence in the Secret Service, which I've exposed in my two books on the Secret Service, long before these latest incidents came out, galvanizes these agents to talk. And, you know, they honestly feel that it's almost a miracle that there has not already been an assassination, given all of this corner-cutting and laxness. So that's part of it. And beyond that, the Secret Service actually cooperated with me on the first book, first time they'd ever done that with a journalist. And they told agents they could talk to me. Of course, the understanding was they weren't supposed to reveal secrets about the people they protect, but all of that helped to give me access, and I was able to interview a canine unit, a real dog, who was supposed to tackle those people on the White House lawn, and went to their training center in Laurel, Maryland with my wife, Pam, who helps write vivid descriptions, and interviewed the director and saw all their operation centers. So all this came together, and I was able to make use of that cooperation as well as interviewing current agents and former agents and really present a complete picture of the Secret Service, how it works, and what they see behind the scenes.
The agents you talked with saw presidents really in the most human of circumstances. Which president was most popular among the Secret Service?
I'd say President Reagan was the most popular. He was just as gracious as he appeared to be on TV. Whenever he went into Air Force One, he would always greet the pilots in the cockpit, whereas Jimmy Carter only did that once in his whole four-year term. Jimmy Carter would pretend to carry his own luggage in front of the cameras, but it was actually empty, or he would give it to aides to carry. He would tell his agents he didn't want them to say hello to him in the morning on the way to the Oval Office. Apparently, it was just too much bother to say hello back. So here you have these leaders who pretend to be compassionate and good old boys, and oftentimes the truth is just the opposite. On the other hand, Barack Obama, this is a totally nonpartisan book, is very respectful of agents, treats them with consideration. So does Michelle. And that, I think, is important when you choose a president. You, in our daily lives, we look at character, when, whether it's to choose a friend or hire a new employee. We certainly don't want someone who treats other people in a nasty way. And that's important when choosing a president. Look what happened with Richard Nixon. He became involved in the episode known as the Checkers speech episode, which was an ethical violation before he was elected. Everyone disregarded that, and sure enough, we got the Watergate scandal. So, of course, we have to look at character when we choose presidents.
This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes, and we're talking with Ron Kessler, investigative journalist and author of The First Family Detail, Secret Service Agents Reveal the Hidden Lives of the Presidents. Well, it must not be easy to protect presidential children, both for the kids and for the agents. Was there one presidential child that was the most difficult to protect?
I'd say Jenna Bush, one of the two Bush twins, because she would try to evade her agents. She would actually go through red lights trying to evade them. The agents would have to conduct surveillance of her car at the White House because she wouldn't tell them where she was going or when she was going. Also, Mary Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, would try to get her agents to take her friends to restaurants. They refused, as they should have. They're not taxi drivers. They, by law, are required to protect certain people, and that's the extent of their responsibilities. And because of that, she got her detail leader removed. She threw a fit and got her detail leader removed because she was mad that the agents wouldn't take her friends to restaurants. And that tells you something about Secret Service management and the fact that they won't back their own agents when they try to enforce security. And that gives you a clue as to why the Salahis crashed the state dinner at the White House, along with a third intruder, Carlos Allen. Even though they were not on the guest list, the agents let them in. Why? Because I think the agents, or actually uniformed officers of the Secret Service, felt that, gee, if we turn them away, and it turns out they were supposed to be on the guest list and there was some error, the White House could get mad at us and our own management will not back us. So that's one of the big problems in the Secret Service today.
Well, a few months ago, President Obama appointed a new director of the Secret Service, Joseph Clancy, after the latest embarrassment with the fence jumper. Do you think we can now have more confidence in the Secret Service?
Well, just a little bit, but really Clancy comes from the same culture that has produced all these problems. It's a culture of we make do with less. We're the great Secret Service. We don't even have to lock the door of the White House because we're so great. We can cut corners because we have many layers of security. And those agents who report problems, such as the female officer did when there were gunshots at the White House in 2011. Her supervisor said, no, it's just some construction site. If she had persisted, she felt that she would have been criticized and retaliated against because there's this culture of cover-up in the Secret Service. It's just outrageous. So Clancy comes from that culture. I don't think he's going to change anything, but I'm pretty confident that we will have a new director from the outside who will shake things up.
And what do you think really needs to be done to really up the ante and improve their performance
and reputation?
As with any organization, when it's in trouble, you bring in an outside CEO, and that's what's needed with the Secret Service. Someone who is not part of this culture, who's not beholden to interest within the Secret Service, I think, for example, an FBI, a former FBI official would be ideal because the FBI has been doing a good job, doesn't have this culture of covering up. But we'll see. There's a four-person panel that's supposed to recommend a new director by December 15th. So I think we'll learn pretty quickly who the new director will be.
Well, Ron, real quickly, has the agency been impacted by budget cuts?
Yes, but actually they're self-imposed. There is this culture of we make do with less, we're wonderful, we don't have to ask for more money. The Secret Service management, it's not the agents who are the problem because they are brave and dedicated, but the management just wants to get a nice job in the private sector, doesn't want to rock the boat, and so they don't ask for more money. You know, if they went to Obama and they said, your life is at risk, we need more money, of course they would get more money, and of course Congress would give them more money. But instead, they creep along like a car without an oil change, and we see the results with all of this laxness and negligence.
Ron Kessler, author of The First Family Detail, Secret Service Agents Reveal the Hidden Lives of the Presidents. Thanks so much for sharing your insights into the Secret Service and for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Up next, everything you need to know about traveling to Antarctica. Stay with us.
Antarctica is considered one of the last frontiers, renowned for its beauty and wildness. 98% of the continent is covered in ice and snow, on average more than a mile thick. It's one of the most pristine places on Earth, mostly untouched by humans.
Our go-to travel guru, Deb Stone, is back with the babes to give us the scoop about traveling to Antarctica and why it should be on our bucket list. Welcome, Deb.
Hey, babes. Good to be back.
Why is going to Antarctica a trip of a lifetime?
You know, it's really an iconic destination, and for most people, it brings to mind this otherworldly, mysterious land of extreme conditions. And I think even for well-seasoned travelers, this is the seventh continent that has remained a bit out of reach, and I think people see it as this incredibly rare opportunity to experience this landscape that it has remained pristine and untouched.
And also a little chilly.
It might be more appealing for people that live in the Bahamas. It's getting really cold around here. I don't know.
Just put on a parka. You know?
So, Deb, when is the best time to go? I mean, I wouldn't imagine it would be summertime anytime.
No, you know what you're going to want to do is choose their summer. And really, the months of the travel season there are October to March. And the best time to go really depends on what you're interested in. If you want lots of ice and penguin laying, then you're going to go early on in the season. December through February, you're going to want to go if you want to observe those little penguin chicks that are hatching. And the tail end of the season towards March brings those whales that are returning to feed.
Okay, so when you talk about with the weather moderating, what are you even talking about? Like if
warming
we want to go in December, what would the weather be like?
Not as bad as some people think because, you know, first of all, this is the continent in summer between those months that I told you about. So really, that the temperature range can be from 14 to 36 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's not so bad.
No.
I'm from Chicago. That's nothing.
Nothing is right.
Okay, so what should we pack then, Deb? I assume not like shorts and sundresses.
Nah, you really don't need that.
Or flip-flops.
You know, some expedition companies provide, which is wonderful, parkas and boots that you can use while you're there so you don't have to lug those along. The common sense dictates you bring layers, long underwear, your, you know, synthetic wool and those silk wicking away clothes, and nothing cotton really, because that doesn't really hold up. And, you know, your fleece, your gloves, your good hat, or waterproof pants for those Zodiac rides that you do off the ship. So, you know, just using your common sense, but everywhere, any company that you're going to choose will provide a packing list for you.
But it must be pretty windy, isn't it? I mean, I pictured this flat, open land.
Well, you know, getting there, most people depart by ship going from Ushuaia, which is the southern tip of Argentina. And crossing the Drake Passage probably is the most challenging part, because the weather can be very changeable. So it could be very smooth, which is what most people want, or it could be rough. And then once you get there, you know, it can be windy, or it can be very calm. So it really is just dependent, and you have to go prepared for any weather. But if you're pressed for time, you can do the air cruise, which means you fly in and out of Antarctica instead of taking the sea days to do that.
Well, just say that we can find our way to Ushuaia, Argentina, wherever the heck that
Ushuaia.
Is.
Ushuaia.
But anyway, if I can find it and I get there and I board a ship, what kind of amenities are offered on these ships?
It varies depending on the ship and what type of style of travel you want, whether, you know, your scale of basic to luxury. But typically, you know, ships are going to have your dining area, your lounge, your lecture rooms, your observation areas, and definitely a medical facility. Some have exercise rooms and spas and jacuzzis, and even offer yoga classes, you know. So it really is your choice in terms of the type of style of travel that you're interested in. Also, what are you interested in observing in terms of wildlife, and what regions that you want to visit on your itinerary?
So how long does it take to get from Argentina to Antarctica?
It takes about 2 days to cross the Drake Passage to reach the continent.
And I'm wondering if there's any way to go besides boat, because if I'll reveal this now, Kathy is not fun on a ship. She doesn't have fun on a ship.
Take your Dramamine, sweetie.
Believe me, I need more than Dramamine.
You know, you can take, like I said, you can take the air cruise, which means you fly to the continent, which means you avoid, you reduce those sea days. But, you know, you're going to be on a ship once you're there, too, because, you know, you will be on that ship traveling around. You will get off the ship and you will make landings in terms of, you know, taking Zodiac boats to make landings. But you're going to be, you know, ship-based for the most part, unless you choose, you know, something, like I said, the air travel, which reduces some of those sea days.
Well, Deb, give us an idea of the tour options and the costs for travel to Antarctica.
First of all, I think there are a number of companies that offer trips. In fact, there's a number that's increasing all the time. But I'm going to talk about one of the most reputable ones that is really at the top of their game and gets a lot of glowing reviews, and that's Adventure Life. And they've been offering expeditions for over 10 years, and they work with 19 different ship operators. But they offer all sorts of trips, once again, luxury, mid-range, or basic. Typically, the ships average about 150 people per voyage. And, you know, the itineraries can offer these active adventures where you can kayak and stand up paddleboard and hike and snowshoe. And some visit, you know, the research stations, and some focus on photography. And no matter what you choose, you're going to have all your meals included, and you'll have the freedom to choose your activities. But the trips depend on the type of tour that you choose and whether you fly or take the ship. It can range from anywhere from 8 days to several weeks. And, you know, this company, in fact, their expedition range from about $4,000 all the way on up to about $43,000 per person.
Wow. Collective wow. So is it ever possible to stay on the continent, or do you always stay on the boat?
No. Well, actually, some trips offer camping on the seventh continent.
Oh, that sounds like our cup of tea, Barbara.
I hope it's at a reduced rate.
So what are these camping accommodations?
Oh, they're these very basic setup tents, and you usually don't do it for more than, you know, one or two nights on there. And it's, you know, it's pretty much, it's going to be a challenging endeavor, and you're, you know, definitely, it's not like you're going to have all your amenities right there in that little tent site. In fact, you don't have any amenities.
And then, Deb, can you see lots of wildlife once you're on the continent?
Yes, you can see wonderful multiple species of penguins, albatross, cormorants. You can see seals, whales, and, you know, you're going to have conversations with the naturalists. You're going to have lectures. You're going to, you know, you could be, like I said, doing all sorts of these other adventure types of activities or focused on photography. And so, you know, it really is going to be your choice, because they offer so many different types of trips and different types of itineraries.
I'm still stuck on when you said we can paddleboard. I mean, I just can't imagine wanting to paddleboard in the Antarctic.
Stand-up paddleboard. I'm sure you would probably need a wetsuit to do so.
I would bet, and some really nice boots.
And aren't there a lot of icebergs you might run
if
into?
If you fell over, you'd have so
it's
many,
called,
much
it's
stuff
steering,
on.
Steering. Steering.
Wouldn't the penguins save us, though?
Oh, sure.
We've seen those movies.
They would save you, Barb, yes.
And not me.
I don't know, Kath. It depends.
Well, travel guru Deb Stone, this really does sound like a trip of a lifetime. And thanks so much for sharing your always fabulous travel tips with the two Boomer Babes.
Well, thanks for having me, gals.
May 22, 1988 was just a typical church-going Sunday for Sue and Jim Meck's family. It was 3 days short of their third wedding anniversary. Jim was a software engineer. Sue was just 22. They had two boys, 2-year-old Benjamin and 8-month-old Patrick. In a flash, their lives turned upside down when a ceiling fan in their home fell and hit Sue in the head. Her body healed within a few weeks, but her memory vanished. Their lives changed forever.
Sue Meck joins us to share the life-altering experience of coping and living with traumatic brain injury. She tells her story in her book, I Forgot to Remember, A Memoir of Amnesia. Sue joins us from Northampton, Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what happened that day. Do you have any memory of the accident?
I do not have any memory of the actual accident, but I have been told about it enough times that I can recount what happened. We were living in Fort Worth, Texas at the time in a little, you know, our little first starter home. And as you say, I was married to my husband, Jim, and had two small children. Benjamin was sitting in his high chair, and Patrick was crawling around on the floor, and I was making supper, and I picked up Patrick at some point and put him over my head, like sort of how face-to-face, just, you know, how you pick up a kid like that, and either his back or his feet or his butt or something hit the ceiling fan and knocked it enough that it came down on top of me, and it was seen later, Jim investigated later and said that it was hung by a plant hook instead of bolted to a beam like it's supposed to be. So it just lifted enough to lift it off of its hook, and that's when it came crashing through the ceiling and hit me. And, I mean, again, but for the grace of God, did not hit Patrick. I handed off Patrick to Jim, and the fan hit me in the right temple, and then I hit the back of my head on a countertop, and then I hit my head again on the floor, and then Jim called 911, and that's sort of what happened after that.
Wow.
Well, Sue, were you conscious for any of this?
I think I was sort of in and out. I know that initially I was knocked unconscious for a considerable amount of time, but the medical records that I got in order to write the book are sort of hazy. They, you know, some say that I was, you know, talking back to nurses at the second hospital. Some say that I was out. Some say that I was in and out. So I think it's probably in between that I was out for a significant amount of time, but I was coming around and sort of in and out for those maybe first 24 hours.
So I would imagine your family would be facing their absolute worst fears, you know, thinking you might not survive.
I was only 22 and Jim was 24. And so I think at that age, you think that you will kind of live forever. So I think it sort of hit Jim when they did say that it didn't look good, because that's sort of like, what do you mean it doesn't look, you know, that doesn't make sense to me because I'm only 24 and 24-year-olds don't die, and, you know. That's how people think. But so, I'm sure he was shocked, and he made phone calls to my parents and to his own parents. And, you know, I'm sure people were thinking and praying and all of that.
Once you woke up or you kind of came out of this coma stage, did you remember life before the accident?
No, I don't have any memories of any of the first 22 years of my life, so anything before the accident. And then even after the accident, my first sort of memories are like being pregnant with Cassidy, which wasn't until 1991. So things are sort of not, I don't remember much even for the next couple of years. I don't remember Texas at all. I don't remember living in Texas at all. We moved to north of Baltimore, and I don't remember that house at all. The first house I remember is in Montgomery County, Maryland, when we lived in Montgomery Village, and that was when I was pregnant with Cassidy in late 1991.
Did you recognize your husband and your kids when you...
Oh, no, not at all.
Not at all. Wow.
Again, this is all coming from Jim. I don't remember not remembering, of course, but... Jim said that, you know, every time he came in, it was almost like he had to be reintroduced to me. It was that blank stare on my face. And same with the boys. And then when my sister and her husband came, it was the same with them and my parents and my brother. I mean, a lot of people sort of came to help. And it was not, it, you know, it was obvious that I didn't recognize people from day to day. And even, you know, months afterwards, I didn't recognize people that I saw every day.
We're talking with Sue Meck about how she's cobbled together fragments of her life after a traumatic brain injury. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes.
So you have no recollection of dating your husband and getting married? And
no.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he does, you know, he obviously does remember those times.
Sure.
I think of her, like, as a different person that, you know, the person that he married was kind of like a different person than I am now. The personality changes are quite significant. So I'm not really anything like she was in terms of personality and likes and dislikes and things. So, yeah, it was, I think it's harder for people that knew me than it is for me, because all I know is what I know. So
Sue, how did you cope with that? I mean, here you were sitting with this man who's your husband, but basically he was a virtual stranger, and same with your kids. You know, how did you develop feelings and really love in spite of the amnesia?
I would say, you know, if I have to put an actual event on when I sort of figured out love, it was when I was pregnant with Cassidy. Again, this is late in 91. When I first went to the doctor and like heard her heartbeat, there was like a thing that was sort of a, I mean, I remember that. I could even tell you what I was wearing that day. That was just like a big day for me. Because before that I was, you know, the whole thought of being pregnant was kind of icky to me. And, when I heard her heartbeat, that was sort of, I guess, sort of a feeling of love. And then of course, when she was born, that's when I sort of understood, wow, that's what everybody's talking about. That's the big deal. And it's not that I don't love my kid, you know, my boys, and I don't love Jim, in a way. It's just a difference, because I was assigned to them more than I was, like, Cassidy. I remember being pregnant with her. I remember her being born, and it's just a different feeling, I guess. I see the boys as actually older than me, because they are, in a way, older than I am.
So I guess, so you had Cassidy after your amnesia, but you were still recovering from the amnesia?
I don't know if you ever really recover from a traumatic brain injury. I think it's something that, like, sort of stays with you your whole life. So it's not like a broken arm that can be set and then it's healed and then you're fine and then you go on with your life. It's a different kind of injury that is different for everybody, first of all, but then it's always sort of there. Like, you always are reminded of it, because you're always reminded of things you don't know and of events you don't, you know, can't relate to when you get together with family and things like that. So it never really is gone away, I guess.
Sue, so how much of your memory has returned?
Nothing. Nothing has come back. I still don't have a memory of anything before the age of probably 25-ish, 24, 25-ish. I know things pretty much up until now, I guess. I feel like I'm more, like I said before the break, I feel like I'm more the age of my children than I do my actual age, just because that's the experiences I've had.
Well, Sue, you know, I can't imagine, while you were trying to recover from this horrible accident, how did you possibly take care of the boys?
I have no idea, which is terrifying to me.
Did you have help?
Well, we had help for a short period of time afterwards, but that didn't work out so well. So, no, I didn't. I don't know. I don't know how, what I did, and I don't know. I think, first of all, I think kids are more resilient than we give them credit for. So I think Benjamin especially stepped up as a 2 or 3 year old, and sort of took charge of things, which sounds like not plausible, but that's essentially what happened. He has, to this day, sort of looks out for me, Benjamin does. So that was sort of like ingrained in him to do.
Wow.
But yeah, it's terrifying. It's terrifying.
We read that Benjamin actually taught you to tie your shoes, and you both studied spelling together.
Oh, yeah. He when he started school, I don't want to say I started school with him, but, you know, we sort of learned things. He, of course, had the benefit of going to school, so he learned things more quickly than I did. But just through spelling words and math homework worksheets and, you know, vocabulary, learning how to read, learning about, you know, history things. I sort of learned those along with all three of my kids, I guess, if you think about it.
Well, Sue, do you think and look at the world in a completely different way since the accident?
I don't know. I mean, I look at the world in an unusual way, I think, just because I tend to be very literal. So, and, you know, that changed, obviously, as I, you know, went to college and graduated from Smith and things. I understand conceptual things a little bit better, but still I struggle with concepts, and so I tend to be a very literal-minded person. So if somebody will say, you know, don't, you know, that's like jumping, you know, if somebody told you to jump off your bridge, it would. Or, you know, if people like say things like that, I'd be like, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't jump off a bridge, you know, and it's, you know, little sayings like that that sort of will catch me off guard. I have a tendency to be a little, Jim calls it Pollyanna, a little naive, I guess, because I haven't experienced terrible things in my life, I guess, which is ironic, I guess.
Well, Sue Mack, thanks so much for so richly telling your story of traumatic brain injury and its toll on your life. There's much more in Sue's book, I Forgot to Remember, A Memoir of Amnesia. Best of luck to you, Sue.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
If you love a contest and live in a really cool small town, listen up. This may be your chance to put your home port on the map. Budget Travel is searching for the best under-the-radar small town in America, population under 10,000, and a certain something that no other place has. Think shops, restaurants, a unique history, location, and art scene. The sky is the limit.
Joining us to shoot the breeze and share some contest info is Budget Travel editor Robert Firpo Capiello. Welcome, Robert.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, I would think it would be really hard to whittle down the best small town. So what specifically are you looking for?
This is the most fun that any Budget Travel editor has all year because it really speaks to the mission of our brand. We hear from tens of thousands of Americans who come to our website and tell us about their cool town. And as you said, we're looking for certain intangibles, a great music scene, a great art scene, great history. Sometimes they all come together in one place. We've had past winners that were chosen as movie locations, which gives you an idea of how beautiful some of their natural settings are. There's also a community spirit that helps. If you can motivate your citizens to contact Budget Travel, come to our website and tell us what's so great about your town. That speaks to the coolness of your village. You're able to get people together, motivated, and willing to tell the world about their town.
So tell us about a few of the towns that are trending this year.
Right now, number one in nominations is Hillsboro, North Carolina. It's a town of about 6,000. And it's a 20-minute drive from Duke University. This place is fascinating because it is a literary hotspot. It's actually home to several well-known writers. Alan Gerganis, who's the novelist who wrote The Oldest Living Confederate Widow, makes his home there. Francis Mays, who wrote Under the Tuscan Sun, lives there. And Gerganis actually plays Scrooge every year in a two-man community theater version of A Christmas Carol. He actually moved from Manhattan back to North Carolina because when his writing took off, he decided he wanted to write in a small town rather than the big city. I'm sort of with him on that.
So that's the town to beat, huh?
Right now, Hillsborough seems to be very well organized, and, you know, this time of year, I start to follow these nominations and learn a bit about the trending towns, and I was very impressed with Hillsborough. No promises, of course, but it's a very exciting place.
Well, Robert, how do towns or people submitting nominations lobby? I mean, do they do any crazy stunts?
To get yourself nominated, you just have to visit budgettravel.com. and tell us a little bit about your town, and then get other people to come and give it a thumbs up. It's a sort of a numbers game. Then the editors go through a process of looking at the big nominations, the big winners, and using some editorial discretion to assemble a list of semifinalists, 15 semifinalists. At that point, when we publish that list of 15 semifinalists, we open it up to a month of voting online, and that's where the stunts do come in, and they really do help. Our winning town in 2014, Berlin, Maryland, they actually composed a bluegrass song called Cool Berlin, and they got it on YouTube, and folks in the town were singing it. They had me singing it. I actually appeared on morning television, and the host dared me to sing Cool Berlin, and I did it. That's a way of getting noticed. The mayors of competing towns sometimes place side bets. This year, Berlin, Maryland, and Cazenovia, New York, were the two top vote-getters, and their mayors bet each other, I believe it was a growler of local craft beer that would go to the winner.
So who actually has the burden of deciding on the best town? I mean, do you have judges?
Mm-hmm. The editors of Budget Travel serve to put together the 15 finalists, which is based on nominations, but also some editorial discretion. We like it to be geographically diverse. We like it to be culturally diverse. After that, once those 15 towns are up on our site from mid-January to mid-February, it's purely a numbers game. The town that gets the most votes is declared the coolest small town in America.
Well, if you're entering a town, do you actually have to reside in the town, or can you just nominate any old town that you just happen to love?
You can nominate any old town. Myself, to get the voting started, I actually live in a cool small town in the Hudson Valley, Irvington on Hudson, New York, and I nominated my town. Of course, I don't expect the editor's town to be the winner. That wouldn't look good.
Yeah, that would smell like a rat.
But I wanted to set a good example for everybody. I posted a picture on Twitter and Instagram. I got the ball rolling. In fact, I've nominated other towns that I especially like. I'm a big fan of some little towns upstate, some towns in California and Montana where I visited. So, yeah, you can nominate any small town you've been to. We are, after all, a travel magazine. We're not all about the best towns to live in. Our interest as editors of Budget Travel is, what are the coolest small towns to visit? Where are you going to get a great meal, hear some great music, visit a great gallery, see some great history?
Well, finally, just give us real quickly the details on the contest, like where to enter and the deadline.
Visit budgettravel.com, two T's, budgettravel.com, and nominations are open through 11:59 p.m. on December 2nd.
Awesome. Budget Travel editor Robert Furpo-Capiello, thanks so much for sharing the info. We can't wait to read which town will be crowned the best.
Sounds great.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.